This is VOA News, coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. The global pandemic continues its cruel assault on the world and its people. The Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 case count is approaching 14.1 million and 600,000 deaths. Part of that picture, China's report that it's found 16 new corona infections in its far western region of Xinjiang. The outbreak in the capital, Urumqi, is the latest to emerge since China largely contained the virus in March. Authorities in the mainly Muslim Uyghur area have reportedly reduced subway, taxi, and bus services and imposed restrictions on people leaving the city. Rail service to the airport has been suspended. Major virus hotspots, the United States, India, and Brazil. Brazil is second in the world with more than 2 million infections and almost 78,000 fatalities. India is next with over 1 million COVID cases and upwards of 26,000 lives lost. Experts say they fear the real numbers are much higher. We'll get to the U.S. figures later. South Korea is reporting another 36 coronavirus infections. Most were imported from outside the country, though 18 cases have been traced to the area in and around Seoul. South Korea has mandated testing and two-week quarantines for travelers from abroad. Australia got some welcome news today. Half the number of virus cases in Victoria State, down from yesterday's record high of 428 to 217. Chief Health Officer Brett Sutton calls it a relief, but he's cautioning people, especially in Melbourne, to remain diligent in a six-week lockdown. In Victoria's neighboring state of New South Wales, there are restrictions that include bans on singing in choirs, dancing in nightclubs, and just mingling. The border between New South Wales and Victoria remains closed. Despite rising COVID case numbers, Albania has decided to open more of its tourist areas. Most foreign visitors are from neighboring Kosovo. Albania has reported just over 4,000 COVID infections, but in the past month, new daily cases have ranged from 50 to 120. That's about double the rate from March through May. More news online at voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. Here in the United States, it is increasingly difficult to find any good news on the reach of the pandemic. Dramatic numbers tell the story. 3.6 million infections, well over 139,000 fatalities, far worse than anywhere else in the world. The major trouble spots are in the South and West, with California, Arizona, Texas, and Florida hit the hardest. The grim death tolls, 15,000 in Texas, 7,600 in California, 4,800 in Florida, and about 2,600 in Arizona. Once again on Friday, COVID cases in the U.S. rose by more than 70,000, though that number was down from 77,000 a day earlier. For the fourth straight day, deaths rose by more than 900. U.S. military medical personnel have been sent into California and Texas to help in hospitals trying to cope with a flood of COVID patients. Both states have been reporting 10,000 new cases a day and more. Among the pressing questions these days is how the continuing spike in COVID numbers will affect President Donald Trump's demand that American public schools fully reopen. At the moment, the chances for that seem remote at best. Texas has become the latest state to say it will keep its schools closed well into the fall. That will involve 5 million children. Under the guidelines, the first 8 weeks of school or the school year in Texas will be limited to online studies. In Chicago, the third largest American school district under a tentative plan, children will be in their classrooms just 2 days a week and spend 3 days in distance learning. California Governor Gavin Newsom has laid out strict criteria for school reopenings that make classroom instruction unlikely for most of his state's school districts. In Iowa, Governor Kim Reynolds says she intends to order school districts to keep their students in the classroom at least half the time. That has Iowa's union teachers upset. U.S. House Democrats are criticizing the White House for blocking the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from testifying at a public hearing on safely reopening schools. Democrats said they invited CDC Director Robert Redfield to testify next Thursday. The administration said no. In Florida, Miami area authorities have begun beefing up enforcement of a local mandate for the wearing of face masks. Governor Ron DeSantis has refused to issue a statewide mask requirement. John Lewis, a pioneer and hero of the U.S. civil rights movement and longtime member of Congress, has died. In December, Lewis announced he had advanced pancreatic cancer. Former President Barack Obama said in a statement, "Through the decades, John Lewis gave all of himself to the cause of freedom and justice and inspired generations that followed to try to live up to his example." John Lewis was 80 years old. Presumptive Democratic Party presidential nominee Joe Biden says he's getting official U.S. intelligence briefings now and has been told Russia is continuing its efforts to meddle in November's U.S. election. Biden warned if he was elected president, there would be a real price to pay for Russia. More news online at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Is need for efforts towards that direction to identify his properties, you know, in around Africa, wherever they exist, if they exist, to ensure that the necessary action is taken to engage those governments responsible to see how to get these properties back to the people of the Gambia.
The people of the Gambia demand an aggressive effort to seize properties of former President Yahya Jammeh.
A lot of people, a lot of organizations, and their own teacher unions, their own employees are kicking against the, say, the continued allowing the students to be in. And so, well, like I said, we are law abiding. We didn't go to the schools to forcibly take our children home, but we will see what we can do.
The Ghanaian National Council of the Parent Teacher Associations is calling on the government to allow high school students to return home to their families.
The president has made the statement, and we are waiting for that investigation to be concluded for us to also react accordingly to the direction of the president.
And a Nigerian civil society group hails President Muhammadu Buhari's efforts to weed out corruption. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The people of the Gambia are calling on their government to confiscate properties owned by former President Yahya Jammeh in the country and abroad, according to Madi Jobate, a prominent human rights activist. He says reports that the U.S. government is accusing the former president of using bribery proceeds and embezzled public funds to purchase a mansion near the capital, Washington, D.C., prompted Gambians to demand more action from the Gambian government. In a civil suit, the U.S. Justice Department accused the former president of acquiring over 281 properties and operated at least 100 private bank accounts using embezzled public funds. Human rights activist Madi Jobate tells me that the court action the U.S. Justice Department is undertaking against former President Jammeh should be a motivating factor for the government in Banjul to also launch an aggressive effort to confiscate his properties.
My reaction to this news is that it's a very welcome development, all contributing to efforts to bring Yahya Jammeh to book. As president, we know Jammeh was notorious for the plunder of our wealth. He was a highly corrupt individual, and from a very rash perspective, this is significant because corruption is in the heart of human rights violations. And so taking public funds to divert it to private ends, either in the Gambia or outside of the Gambia, meant Gambians were lacking in basic goods and services where public funds should have gone into, instead of, you know, using it to buy properties or to engage in activities at home and abroad. So we welcome this. I think, if anything, it is to urge the Gambia government to urgently engage with the U.S. government so that if they finally succeed to obtain this property, that it becomes the property of the Gambia, the Gambian nation, you know, whether as a property over there or if it is sold, the proceeds are brought back to the Gambian people. So this is indeed a welcome move.
Madi, some Gambians are suggesting that the administration in Banjul should have made efforts and contacted the U.S. government to have acted on this quicker than now, knowing very well that the former president has property in the U.S. that he acquired while he was head of state. What is your reaction to this?
Yes, one would have imagined the Gambia government would have taken all necessary steps, not just the U.S. government, but all other concerned governments, countries where Jammeh had operated, I mean, owned properties, things like that. So I wouldn't know if the Gambia government had done that. But I mean, if not, then I would say they should have. And given that this has come more than 3 years after Jammeh left, and the Gambia government indeed has never made any public announcement about efforts in that regard, it would tell me, what I read from this is that this is basically a U.S. government initiative individual unilateral initiative, not influenced by the Gambian government, which is really concerning because what does this mean? That if the U.S. government had not made this initiative, it would not have, you know, taken place.
Madi, some Gambians are suggesting that the administration in Banjul should have made efforts and contacted the U.S. government to have acted on this quicker than now, knowing very well that the former president had property or has property in the U.S. that he acquired while he was head of state. What is your reaction to this?
The news is really well received here. A number of media houses, newspapers, online papers have carried this story, and it's been widely circulated on social media as well. Indeed, it's well received here. I think people are trying to, you know, understand what all of this means. So it's generating conversations, in groups and wherever people meet. Yeah, so it's indeed a welcome, news that people are happy to receive.
But Madi, how are the Gambians reacting to this news following report that this is what the U.S. government is doing in terms of the property or the house that the former president owns here in the U.S.?
Definitely the government should pursue all properties of Jammeh that are located outside of the Gambia as they are doing inside the Gambia. But that information has to be made available. I think it's more or less public knowledge that he has properties in Guinea-Conakry and Morocco. I'm not sure this is, you know, independently verified or, and in any case, the Gambia government hasn't shown that indeed such properties exist somewhere. But yeah, there is need for efforts towards that direction to identify his properties, you know, in around Africa, wherever they exist, if they exist, to ensure that the necessary action is taken to engage those governments responsible to see how to get these properties back to the people of the Gambia.
Madi Jobate is a prominent human rights activist. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In Ghana, the National Council of the Parent Teacher Associations is calling on the government to allow high school students to return home to their families. This following reports of increasing cases of the coronavirus infection on school campuses across the country. The group says the government has been unable to implement safety protocols to limit the spread of the disease among the students despite repeated promises. It also called for a postponement of the upcoming examination. Alexander Yao Danso, the head of the National Council of the Ghanaian Parent Teacher Associations, tells me that the group disagrees with the government's plans to keep the students at school while failing to protect them from the spread of the disease.
They are saying allowing the children to go back home will infect the public, you know, when they are joining buses, and also infect their families. But the question is, after the exams, won't they go back home? Definitely after exams, they'll go back home. And again, they are not being tested, as I speak with you now, because they have said it categorically that they are not going to test them. And so definitely they are not testing them. And so from now to September, when they will finish with the exams, a lot of things will happen. It will go bad. I heard this evening that a school in Banda Senior High School, you know, where the police were guarding, the students have left and they have all gone home. So that is it. That is the situation now. And we still stand by our statement that the students must be allowed to go back home.
What do you say to those who are saying that it appears your group is trying to score cheap political points and that a lot of schools around the world are returning to school, so Ghana should follow suit?
Those who are saying that do not know what is happening. Now, a lot of people have joined the crusade that the children must go home. Definitely all those who are saying are party members. They are, you know, we can't politicize education. And definitely the fact that we are having free education does not mean you know, you should force the children to, by all means, be in school and then sit for the exams. Yes, some of the countries have even postponed, rescheduled their timetable for the academic calendar. And so definitely Ghana can follow suit, because most of the West African countries are not really, they are all not doing, apart from Ghana, they are all not sitting for the WASI exams. And so why should we rush in conducting an exam for the children, when psychologically, the children wouldn't even have the right frame of mind to sit for the exams. And so definitely those who are saying we just want to score cheap political points, it's neither here nor there. And they don't seem to understand the situation.
Well, Mr. Danso, the government stated that it had made provisions for the supply of personal protective equipment for both the student and the teachers with the aim of limiting the spread of the coronavirus disease among the students. What do you say to that?
To be honest with you, as at last Friday, 5:30 in the evening, some schools in the Greater Accra region had not got their supply of the PPEs the government promised. And even those who have got them have not got the full complement of the PPEs. And so it's only the IMPs, the old boys and old girls, and the parents had, as they wait for the government supply, had provided them with the PPE. So even yesterday, the Ghana National Association of Teachers issued a statement that they have been deceived into thinking that PPEs have been supplied to all schools. Some of the schools have not got their supply of the PPE. And so I phoned about two schools where I spoke with the school heads, and they were telling confidently, you know, they confided in me that they have got their supply, but it's not even halfway. So that some of the teachers had not even got theirs. So yes, government has promised to supply. They have done the supply all right, but not all schools have got their supply of the PPE.
Mr. Danso, what is the next line of action for the National PTA in Ghana about this concern? Because people are wondering, where do they go from here, particularly when the voter registration exercise for the students have been conducted, and now it's only for the students to get ready for their examination before the term is over. Where does the National PTA go from here regarding its call for the student to be allowed to go home?
Let's not forget that the children are our children. The child, the center of the controversy, is being surrounded by three pillars. That's the government, the teacher, and the parent. One cannot do away with the other. But it's as if in Ghana here, parents have been relegated to the background, to the extent that even taking decisions on their own children, they are relegated to the background. We are going to pursue our case. And unfortunately, a lot of people, a lot of organizations, and their own teacher unions, their own employees are kicking against the continued allowing the students to be in. And so, well, like I said, we are law abiding. We didn't go to the schools to forcibly take our children home, but we will see what we can do. When the government was telling Ghanaian parents, all what they told us was that the students are going to do their revision, then possibly sit for the exams. Nowhere did they mention that students are going to be registered by the Electoral Commission. But last week, Thursday, all what we heard was that the Electoral Commission had issued a statement saying they were going to register the students the following, the last Friday and Saturday. If we had been informed, we would have even reminded our children to take along their national identification card and that of their passport, those who have, so that they will do the rest. But this we are not told.
Alexander Yao Danso is the head of the National Council of the Ghanaian Parent Teacher Associations. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. In Nigeria, a civil society group has welcomed as a positive development an inquiry into allegations of corruption at the Niger Delta Development Commission. The Coalition for Good Governance in the Niger Delta State says a move by President Muhammadu Buhari to ensure a speedy yet thorough investigation into alleged corrupt practices at the State Development Agency sends the right message of his commitment to root out corruption in the West African country. Jefferson Oriagurie, chairman and convener of the Coalition for Good Governance in Niger State, tells me that the fight to weed out corruption in the Niger Delta State and Nigeria as a whole must be won irrespective of the challenges.
Yeah, many Nigerians have blamed Buhari since the recent crisis have rocked the Niger Delta Development Commission, and that Buhari have not spoken, Buhari have not done anything yet, and he's saying what is happening, and he was the center of anti-corruption when he came in 2015 to contest presidential election. However, when recently, when we saw that he made a statement via his media aid, we deem it fit to congratulate him because many Nigerians have been expecting him to speak on the issue, to bring this issue to book.
If I may ask you, Jefferson, what are your expectations with this investigations? Because some people have said that usually there are investigations, but the culprits or the perpetrators are not punished. So what do you want to see in this investigation?
Actually, many civil society have called for the likes of PricewaterhouseCoopers suggesting to the presidency for a forensic investigation audit on the Niger Delta Development Commission. The truth remains the fact that we were all expecting the president to act, and now that he has actually released a statement, I think the investigation is on. We are waiting for the outcome. He also made mention recently that all government appointees and political office holders should respect the National Assembly. And from the point where he's coming from, he is actually ready to take the bull by the horns to ensure that the forensic audit and investigation are concluded for a resolution to be reached on the perpetrators and those that are involved in the embezzlement.
Now, one of the reasons why your group is praising President Muhammadu Buhari's efforts to speed up the investigation, you think, is that the Niger Delta Development Commission is not doing what it's supposed to do. Why do you say that?
You agree with me that if you are very abreast with what is happening in the region, physically you see a lot of abandoned projects that are not executed, that are not implemented. And a lot of money have been passing through the coffers, through the budget of NDDC, which are judged to frivol excuses and appropriation, which is not meant to be. The essence of the commission is to actually provide basic infrastructure like roads, good education, support education systems, etc., and many other things that can benefit the grassroots of the Niger Delta. But to our own surprise, a lot of money has passed through, especially with this interim management committee that was recently set up to manage the commission. We discover and find out that there are a lot of embezzlement, a lot of corruption and malpractices that have been going on without due respect to the primary aim of actually establishing the commission. There are a lot of rules about the Niger Delta area, the Niger Delta that was supposed to make provision. A lot of rules, a lot of things have been included in the industry budget yet. The labor release funds for those physical infrastructural development. And what we are seeing is just men is spending money for condolence for the tune of billions. No, it's not done. This is not good governance, and we stand against it. And our crusade is for good governance. The NDP should provide good governance at the level that we, the citizens, will understand that, yes, we are benefiting from our resources.
Jefferson, what do you say to critics or skeptics who are of the opinion that in spite of this investigation that is currently ongoing, nothing is going to change at the Niger Delta Development Commission because investigations have been conducted in the past, perpetrators are not punished, and so this is just a mere publicity stunt and that nothing will change? What do you say to that?
Well, we are watching and we are also monitoring the situation, the development. I believe if at the end of the day nothing is being done to the perpetrator, we at the good governance, we are known for advocate for government, and I believe we will continue the crusade and we'll continue the cry, and we will ensure we get to the root of it. We will ensure we write to the presidency about it. But for now, we keep our fingers crossed. We are watching the direction the presidency is going. Let us see at the end of the day how the result is going to come, how the decision they are going to take to ensure that the president are brought to book. If nothing is done to them, then we'll also release a statement as regards that. But for now, the president have made the statement, and we are waiting for that investigation to be concluded for us to also react accordingly to the direction of the president.
Jefferson Oriagorie is the chairman and convener of the Coalition for Good Governance in Nigeria's Niger Delta State. He spoke with me from the Niger Delta State capital, Asaba. In Gabon, a civil society group leader says the appointment of Madame Rose Christiane Usuka Raponda as the new prime minister is unlikely to have any major impact on the lives of the people. The appointment makes Ms. Raponda the first female prime minister in the Central African country since it gained independence. Loris Ndong, head of Let's Turn the Page, says the new prime minister will simply carry out what President Ali Bongo Ondimba wants instead of what she contends are the necessary reforms to improve the living conditions of Gabonese. Civil society leader Loris Ndong tells me that for a real change to happen in Gabon, the entire government needs to go.
The main problem of Gabon is the illegitimacy of this regime. Those who are in charge of the country stole the elections since 1999, the election to 1999 and 2016, you know. It killed people, and the governance of the Gabon is the worst, the bad governance in the Central Africa. So in this context, they can choose any prime minister. Things will not go well in the country. The problem of Gabon is the lack of democracy, the bad governance, the stall of the election. So for us, they can change prime minister. Even if it's a woman, it means nothing for us. Because what we want is this regime to have to change those people, because they ruled the country since 52 years, and the Gabon is very, very, very in a very bad situation now.
Ms. Ndong, are you saying that despite the fact that a lot of people are praising the government for having the former defense minister become the prime minister, to have a female touch to policies that could improve the lives of Gabonese, this is really that it doesn't really matter? Is that what you're saying?
No, it doesn't really matter, because in Gabon, the will of just the president is taking account. All the prime ministers are there just to do what the president says. The president, Ali Bongo, in the last decade, she's for the seventh prime minister in 10 years. They change prime minister every 2 years. Those who were in charge will be prime minister since January the last year. Is there just 1 year and a half? So they change the prime minister every time. And there is no touch of the prime minister, of the policy in the country, because it's only the president who decided everything. And since 2 years, the president is sick. Nobody sees him. Everybody, we know that he's not ruled the country now. He's unable to rule the country. And we don't know who rules the Gabon now. We don't know if it is woman, if the wife of the president, the child of the president. We don't know about anything what is going on at the top of the country. So they can change the prime minister. It's not anything for us, because they change prime minister every year.
Ms. Ndong, there are suggestions by Gabonese that the new prime minister is expected to bring fresh ideas and new policies because she is young, she is vibrant, and she can work to ensure that the female or the girl child in Gabon is protected, and that this is a breakthrough or breaking the glass ceiling for Gabonese women. What do you say to that?
You know, this woman who is prime minister now, she was the first female mayor in Libreville, the first city of the country, and she didn't change anything in the city. We know this woman. She was the first female mayor of Libreville. When she left the mayor of Libreville, the city was the most dirty city in Africa. She was the second female minister of defense. Nothing there. And now she's the prime minister. You know, it's just enough to be a woman for changing things. She's not the system, the regime is bad. And even you are a competent, but when you are in this regime, you can do anything because you have to obey to what the president wants. We have to change the president first.
So Ms. Ndong, what are your expectations since you are calling for a change in president? You are looking at it, some would say, politically instead of looking at it pragmatically, that if perhaps this female new prime minister will make things better for people. What are your expectations, if I may ask you?
Every day, Gabonese people are killed by this regime. Civil society can manifest. They are reproved all the time because of the regime. So this nomination is, for us, another prime minister like the others. We don't expect anything because this regime is at the top of the country since 52 years, the same family doing the same thing. Embezzlement, robbing the election, repressed population, lack of democracy, lack of human rights in the country. And this woman will not change things as we can expect that. She couldn't because she served a dictatorship.
Laurie Sindong is the head of Let's Turn the Page, a civil society group in Gabon. She spoke with me from the French capital, Paris. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, a Ugandan opposition parliamentarian says opposition political parties will support a postponement of next year's elections until the global coronavirus pandemic is over to allow for credible polls. Attorney Mathias Mpuuga denies accusations that the opposition parties insist on carrying out regular campaigning with big crowds in spite of the disease. The criticism, he says, was aimed at branding the reputation of opposition leaders as wicked and uncaring in an effort to limit its electoral prospect. His comments come after opposition groups expressed concern that the Electoral Commission launches election-related programs without consulting the opposition. Ugandans are scheduled to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives in next year's election. Parliamentarian attorney Mathias Mpuuga tells me that opposition parties will not be deterred in their effort to ensure the elections are transparent and credible.
They're talking about an undertaking over a very critical national exercise that is not addressed in any legal framework. It is a conception of their own. Our constitution does not support that kind of arrangement. Even our electoral laws do not support it. Therefore, it's just a gamble. And one of the reasons why some of us are saying it's an exercise in futility. It cannot engender the kind of electoral democracy we want to entrench in our country. It can only serve to entrench a military regime in Kampala. And we are averse to this kind of arrangement.
But Matthias, some people are saying the opposition groups are not being fair in the fact that the lives of people have to be protected. And that is what the government is doing, including implementing measures to limit the spread of the coronavirus. And that is why going around doing regular campaigning might not necessarily work. What do you say to that?
The beauty is that our constitution envisaged that this kind of situation could arise and make it impossible to hold a normal election. And where that was provided for, the constitution did allow parliament to extend the term of government for 6 months to allow for normals to return and organize a normal election. An election per se is not an event. It is a very serious national undertaking. It's not a ritual that we must undertake even when the conditions do not allow for performance of this key national duty, which is why we have advised that where it's not possible to hold an election envisaged under our electoral laws, the election could be postponed to take care of the challenges that COVID has posed. Instead of going for an election that is laden with irregularities and all forms of injustices that could limit the participation of the people, power belongs to the people. And when they are exercising this power, they must be given an environment that favors the exercise of this power. not for the sake of exercising it.
Matthias, what do you say to political analysts in Uganda who are of the opinion that instead of the opposition parties to form an alliance straightening your path in order to pose a significant challenge to the ruling party and President Museveni in next year's election, you are rather complaining about how the Electoral Commission is organizing the elections with the COVID-19 in its mind to limit the spread of the disease. What do you say to that?
We are coming from a history of a partial Electoral Commission, an Electoral Commission that from day one is biased and therefore unable to give Uganda an opportunity to freely take a decision without really having to tamper with the decision. So we have never found it difficult to work together. But because of the political environment which we operate, we even find it difficult to start discussing alliances before discussing the environment in which a potential alliance is going to operate. The solidity, the success of any alliance is as good as the environment in which it's going to perform. So it's not just about an alliance for the sake of it. We want to talk about the election environment. We want to talk about the partiality of the Electoral Commission as a part and parcel of the kind of environment we want to operate and do politics from. Otherwise, there are so many groups that are willing and ready to work together, but they're complaining about the fact that it does not make sense for us to work together in a ritualistic environment. We want an environment in which our decisions and the decision of Ugandans will matter anyway, at the end of the day.
Matthias, the analysts are saying the NRM, including President Museveni, appear to be looking very strong after so-called the rebel members of parliament went to beg him for forgiveness at the state house. This, they said, shows unity and that the NRM will be much prepared to defeat the divided opposition in next year's general election. What are your thoughts?
What I can say is that stealing an election, or stealing elections for that matter, is not an act of a strong and decent human being. The regime has been stealing elections because it does know for a fact that it doesn't have very strong grassroots support. We are aware we have had Supreme Court, you know, judgments that have indicted the regime for tampering with the elections, either using the military and other machinations. These are not acts of a party that has strength. The regime is extremely vulnerable, which is why they will stop at nothing in trying to tamper with the free choice of Ugandans. The actions of the so-called rebels, for me, do not bother me. First of all, from the word go, they are NRM party supporters. They were opposed to the extension of Mr. Museveni's presidency. That did not make them NLS of NRM supporters. They were NRM supporters, but opposed to the leadership of Mr. Museveni. All they wanted was another person to lead the NRM and the country by extension.
Attorney Matthias Mpuga is a Ugandan parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, police in Uganda used tear gas Friday to break up a crowd of supporters outside the offices of the opposition People Power Movement. Critics say police often target opposition rallies but never break up gatherings of the ruling party. For VOA, Halima Tumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The People Power Movement office was humming with activity Friday as aspiring candidates picked up and returned nomination forms for 2021 general elections. As aspirants walked in, so did their supporters, chanting People Power Movement songs. That attracted the attention of police, who at first monitored the situation, then fired tear gas. One of the aspirants who returned their forms Friday is opposition legislator Francis Zake, whose arrival sparked excitement among the dozens who had gathered outside the office, many donning red berets and red overalls. Zake, who currently moves around on crutches, is still nursing a spinal injury and has leg paralysis after his arrest in April. He was allegedly assaulted while detained by security agencies for defying presidential directives. He says this is not the time to be scared of the government.
Even when you're injured, even when you're lame, even when I feel that I'm not yet well, but I can do this, meaning that this is what we have to do to get our freedom. The moment we don't do this, there's no way how people are going to be inspired so that you break those chains.
Joel Senyonyi, the People Power spokesperson, says the group has so far received nomination forms from 5,500 people. He says the continuous battle with police is only invigorating the party.
It shows that the state is fearful. That's why they will deploy heavily at the People Power offices. But ours is to say that where we are holding seems to be the right place, we'll hold even harder.
Opposition supporters have criticized police in recent weeks for cracking down on opposition functions and arresting its members. In contrast, the police let members of the ruling National Resistance Movement under President Yoweri Museveni carry on without any hindrances. But Patrick Onyango, the Kampala Metropolitan Deputy Police Spokesperson, says the opposition members have defied presidential directives meant to control the spread of COVID-19.
We are moving in a procession, which is a campaign, by the way, and it is not allowed. And they were blocking roads in and around Kamocha, which is also not allowed in the current situation where we are supposed to keep distance. So we have to use a bit of tear gas to disperse them.
In its recently released electoral roadmap, the Uganda Electoral Commission has urged all aspirants to observe procedures to stop the spread of COVID-19. Candidates have also been advised to use electronic media to campaign to avoid crowds. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Aid agencies are asking wealthy nations to support the UN's $10 billion appeal for life-saving aid to a quarter billion people whose lives and livelihoods are threatened by the COVID-19 pandemic. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The pandemic is wreaking havoc around the world. The coronavirus has infected well over 13 million people globally, causing more than 500,000 deaths. The United Nations says people everywhere are suffering, but those in developing and fragile countries are most affected. They are least able to tackle the health and economic crisis. Among the most vulnerable and in need of aid are the urban poor, women and girls threatened by gender-based violence, children, the elderly, people with disabilities, and mental health issues. A spokesman for the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says the number of starving people is increasing and could reach some 270 million by the end of the year. He says the devastation caused by the pandemic is too great to ignore by the world's rich countries. He says it would be dangerously short-sighted for them not to invest in the protection of the world's most vulnerable people. To do so, he warns, risks triggering new COVID-related crises.
No one on this planet will be safe from the virus till everyone is safe from it. We know that food shortages and starvation lead people to move, and they foment conflict, which is also a perfectly exportable problem. So again, we are urging the world to show generosity, not only because it's the humane thing to do, but also because it's in their self-interest.
The first global humanitarian response plan for COVID-19, launched in March, requested $2 billion. It was updated in May, seeking $6.7 billion. This is the third iteration of the appeal, and as the emergency has increased, so has the amount of money needed to respond. The current updated plan deals with basic health services, including immunization, mother and child health care. However, the bulk of aid will go toward food, preventing famine, and improving nutrition, water supplies and sanitation, as well as livelihoods, shelter, and protection against gender-based violence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Watoto wa bibi wanacheza kote mpaka kwenye matope wanavua wiki Kama wamegongana na epito fanya kama unadukua
twende sasa
unanengua
twende sasa
napika na pakua
twende sasa
chukua
twende sasa sema bo 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 tunakesha popo
lenda chupa kwa chupa na moshi tulewe
tunakesha popo
nasema bo 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 bo
tunakesha popo
shika pesa tusepe silali mwenyewe
tunakesha popo
ana sasa mbua
Kalewa
ana kipino
Kalewa
ana jichetua
Kalewa
ay 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 ay
Kalewa
amaboko
eh amaboko
amagulu
eh amagulu
amaboko
eh amaboko
amagulu
eh amagulu
aggressive
Asa baby show, show nishali chokupa mama Baby go, go, mesha usijali lawama Anasi piti titi, kwendofo chichi chichi Katoto kuchi kuchi, kwenye kuchi kichiki Kwenye nyomi kijiji, kwanyoni tigigi Twende baka moni kibiji, kenza meshe moni kimbiji Katoto kana papara,
para
Kwenye meki para
para
mutaka masigara
ra ra
ra nasema bo 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 bo
tunakesha popo
tumbesa cha ukucha na monde tulewe
tunakesha popo
anangu bo 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 bo
tunakesha popo
kama kiko mafuta silale mwenyewe
tunakesha popo
ayeye
kimempan
oh kidaluso
kimempan
kaisha leo
kimempan
somba kama fuso
kimempan
umo
amaboko
eh amaboko
amagulu
eh amagulu
amaboko
eh amaboko
amagulu
eh amagulu
aggressive
mwaga maji tucheze kama kambale leo ni vaniko Mwaga maji tucheze kama kambale Yo ni vaniko, yuko na mtoto atandale
Sachezesha kileso,
kileso
Akileso, kileso,
kileso
Sazungusha kileso,
kileso
Kileso, kileso,
kileso
Aga, kauna kibana kwa kwa pa
Kileso
Kinete kwa kwa pa
Kileso
Mungarusha na tapa
Kileso
Swa doctor
Kileso
Different time. Oh, 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 o
come tire for me. Make you no go to yawa for me. I feel to love you tire. And you really go on. No go come tire for me. Make you no go to yawa for me.
Baby,
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you think you are too small to make a difference, you haven't spent the night with a mosquito. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.